Hello everyone, my name is Christoph and you're listening to History of Asia. In this podcast, we look at the present situation in Asia and we ask ourselves how it got to this point. Now, given the current state of Syria and Iraq, in their case, this is like a crime scene investigation. Someone did something wrong, that much is clear. But who done it? To find this out, we started by reconstructing the recent past. And at first glance, the case looked easy enough to solve, because you have these cartoon villains caught red-handed, terrorists who keep sex slaves and like to burn people alive, Dr. Death bombing hospitals and torturing children. It's obvious that they are responsible. But then the devil's advocate stepped up and started arguing, just look a little further back. If the Americans don't overthrow Saddam Hussein, then Iraqi Sunnis never feel so victimized. ISIL never comes into existence. Jihadists don't get to infiltrate the Syrian resistance like they do. And then this resistance perhaps can form an acceptable alternative to the Assad regime. The situation might then look a lot better. But then the Americans' lawyers retort that it was Saddam who laid the groundwork for the chaos and hatred that followed the Iraq war, undermining institutions, playing divide and rule. But he and the Assads would have something to say in their favor too, namely, it's not as if they did things so much differently from those that preceded them. They were just more successful. The rules had been set long before, and one of these rules was, either you remain in power or you die. So you do whatever it takes to survive. Don't hate the players, they would say, hate the game. This, I think, is the equivalent of saying, sure, he was a criminal and sure, he's guilty. But look at the neighborhood that the poor boy grew up in. It's easier to stay in school when you grow up in the Upper East Side than in the Bronx, I suppose. So blame society, blame trends and forces. Blame the complicated relationship that Iraqis and Syrians have with their state. It is this that made it so hard to build strong institutions and that led to the dynamic of state capture. And why was this relationship so complicated? Because these states, Iraq and Syria, were forced on their inhabitants by Europeans. They redrew the map of the Middle East in the wake of the First World War. And for a short period after that, Syria and Iraq were ruled by France and Britain respectively. These artificial creations have proven remarkably resilient, despite many attempts to do away with them. So in a way, the Europeans are the fathers of the modern Middle East. There are more than a few people who feel that this makes them the real culprits for the current mess, more than 100 years later. Before we can begin to ask whether this is fair, I think we should first look at what happened then exactly and why. So there's nothing else to it, I suppose. We'll have to dust off the old time machine again and go back to the beginning of the 20th century. Before the Great War, Syria and Iraq had for ages been ruled by the Ottomans. Their giant empire had once been formidable, but it had slowly degenerated until it became known as the sick man of Europe. The main reason why it was still there at all was that Western powers wanted a buffer against further expansion of Tsarist Russia. That's why they supported the Turks in the Crimean War, for instance. However, as the end of the 19th century neared, Western Europeans became convinced that they should take the Middle East for themselves. North Africa, once also in Ottoman hands, had already come under their dominion. When World War I beckoned, they put aside their differences with the Tsar, and the Ottoman Sultan made the fateful choice to throw in his lot with their common enemy, Germany. In hindsight, it turned out to be a fatal mistake. But you couldn't predict in advance who would win this war. A German victory may have been the Sultan's best hope of survival. There were many reasons why the Kaiser welcomed this alliance, but perhaps the most important one was symbolic. The Sultan was also the Caliph, the symbolic head of Sunni Islam, and it just so happened that both the British and the French had millions of Muslim subjects in their colonies. Sure enough, one of the first things the Sultan did on entering the war was calling on all these people to wage jihad on their Christian masters. As you can imagine, there was some nervousness about that in London and Paris. The British especially looked for ways to counter this narrative. What they needed was a Muslim ally of their own who could counterbalance the Caliph. So in 1915, High Commissioner McMahon sent a letter to Sharif Hussein of Mecca. He promised him an independent Arab kingdom in return for his help in kickstarting an Arab rebellion against the Ottomans. The Sharif had impressive religious credentials himself, due to his guardianship of Mecca and his family bond to the Prophet. And since an important part of the Ottoman Empire was Arab in ethnicity, including Syria and Iraq, the prospect of an Arab insurrection looked promising to the Allies. The Sharif's son Faisal would take charge. But while helping the war effort, the Arab revolt would remain all in all quite humble, and mostly driven by Bedouin warriors from Arabia. Most of the heavy lifting would still have to be done by the Europeans themselves. And these were not all ready to leave the Middle East to the Arabs. They had strategic interests there, after all. Well, some of them did. It's important to always keep in mind that, like all Arabs didn't support the same policies necessarily, the same was true for the British or the French. In case of the French, for instance, there was a strong Christian lobby wanted to protect Christians in Syria, while a totally different, more business-minded lobby merely wanted privileged access to local markets. Some British policymakers were quick to recognize the rising importance of Middle Eastern oil, Winston Churchill among them. This largely explains why in 1916 the British and the French concluded one of the most infamous treaties in world history, known as the Sykes-Picot Agreement. The reason it's so infamous is that it contradicted the earlier promise made to the Sharif to recognize and uphold the independence of the Arabs. It was therefore a secret treaty. It set out to create a future zone of influence for France that would encapsulate Syria, including the later Lebanon, and another one for Britain that would contain Iraq with its oil fields. In the end, the British would also claim dominion over Palestine and the barely inhabited corridor that connected it to Iraq, now known as Jordan. The reason for that latter part was yet another contradictory offer that the British made. In 1917, their foreign minister, Lord Balfour, sent a letter to Walter Rothschild, scion of the famous Rothschild banking family. In it, he pledged British support for an independent Jewish home in Palestine. Different reasons have been suggested for this offer. To the naive observer, the goal seems noble and obvious. Jews had been subjected to terrible discrimination for centuries, so of course they needed a national home. That was what the Zionist movement had been all about. There was also a Christian lobby sympathizing with this project. But counterintuitively, some anti-Semites also supported the idea, because it would mean, as they would see it, getting rid of their own Jews. Let the Arabs worry about them. Indeed, it was predicted in advance that this new Jewish homeland would not live in peace with the people who already inhabited that region. Not hard to see why. But perversely, some saw this as an upside. It would mean that the Zionists would certainly keep needing British protection for a long time, which would ensure that the Zionist state would remain a dependable ally, and this in a region of major strategic importance. And so too with their supporters like the Rothschilds. Indeed, most insidiously, some fans of the Balfour Declaration supposedly bought into the conspiracy theories that Jews would have immense control over international politics. If the British convinced them that if they won the war and controlled Palestine as a result, then they would enable the creation of a new Zion. If the Zionists believed that, then they could be expected to muster their supposedly mighty influence to the British cause. It all sounds pretty devious, doesn't it? But to be fair to the British, they were caught up in a battle for survival themselves. They sought help anywhere they could find it. If that meant making a few contradictory promises, then so be it. Although all these concessions contain certain caveats and vague notions, they are generally assumed to be incompatible with one another. The other parties' understanding of them certainly were. Now, the Jews eventually got their homeland, and more than originally originally planned for, even as a result of the wars to come. And the French and the British did get their zones of influence too. So I think it's safe to say that it was the Arabs who would get the short end of the stick. Instead of becoming independent, they would be put under mandate. In theory, that meant that the mandatory powers, the British and the French respectively, would prepare them for independence. But unsurprisingly, the Europeans showed no enthusiasm for this task. Why would they? They had strategic interests in their mandate areas, which is why they fought over them and why they had claimed them in the first place. So they had no intention to just give them up. The mandate was an excuse for colonization in a period when this had gone out of fashion, in a time when both the American president Woodrow Wilson and the Russian communists proclaimed that they were for self-determination of nations. The final outcome mirrored the military facts on the ground. The Arab revolt had proven modest, and the influence of the Sharif limited. Most Arabs had stayed loyal to the Ottomans, as had most Kurds, by the way. Most of the fighting had been done by the British. They had already landed in Basra in 1914, and by the end of the war, they had control over the entire region. The fate of the region was still not totally decided. It had yet to be seen how all these conflicting wartime agreements would play out in practice. The locals didn't wait around for others to decide their fate, however. In 1919, a constituent assembly for Greater Syria was elected, and a year later, it proclaimed Faisal king. Their instincts seemed to be as democratic as one could hope for, I suppose. Furthermore, Faisal made promising noises himself. He could have laid all his eggs in the basket of the Sunni majority, but instead, he ensured minorities that they would enjoy equal rights. He proclaimed in favor of free elections, and he even suggested he might abide by the idea of a Jewish home on certain conditions. I think this sounds almost too good to be true, especially when compared to the divisive and exclusive policies that come after. However, the French didn't want the Syrians to decide their own affairs. They demanded their mandate. Now, in theory, the British could have said no, I guess, but France was one of their most valuable allies at that point. They didn't feel they could afford to ignore their demands, or ignore the Sykes-Picot agreement. Also, Faisal didn't have much leverage anymore, as far as they were concerned. His help was no longer so valuable as it had been during the war, and it had been disappointing anyway, so they felt that he should be thankful for whatever they were willing to give him. And he didn't prove very grateful in their eyes. He went to Paris to passionately plead for Arab freedom. His words fell on deaf ears, however. The only thing that he accomplished with this maneuver was to alienate many of the British. This partly explains, I think, why they did little to stop the Saudis from taking over the Sharif's homeland in the Hejaz. And they didn't lift a finger either when the French moved in to claim their mandate in Syria. Being Republicans, the French wouldn't hear of an Arab monarch. Besides, they feared that Faisal would be too popular, especially among the Sunni majority. The Syrians would fight for their honor, but it was a hopelessly unequal battle. The resistance would have to rely on volunteers, armed with stones, and they were up against an experienced French modern army with planes and tanks. It wouldn't be the last time in their history that they faced such odds. As a consolation prize of sorts, the British did welcome Faisal in Iraq and installed him there as king. His commanders would form the core of the government. Many of them were former Ottoman officers who had taken the offer to join the Arab revolt after being captured. Among them was Nouri al-Said, who would become the preeminent Iraqi politician of the coming era. It's kind of funny how their initial defeats against the Sharifian army would eventually bring them more power than they could ever have hoped to attain if they had been victorious. Now, it may seem a nice gesture of the British to give Faisal a crown anyway, but they also had cynical reasons for this. He and his people had few connections in Iraq. Most people didn't even know who he was, and his crown must have lost much of its remaining luster because of the clear fact that he owed it to foreign occupiers. That's often the case, but it doesn't look too kingly, does it? Many Iraqis felt like this king was forced on them, especially the Shiites and the Kurds. All the more so because Faisal then encouraged Syrian officials to migrate to Iraq, where they were often promoted, and also because he kept promoting the idea of one large Arab kingdom, which would bring him back to power in Syria. But Iraqi Shiites understood that if this happened, they would no longer be a majority in their own land. So Iraq's rulers were not popular, and this suited the British just fine because it made them deliciously dependent. Perhaps thankful for an opportunity to remind them of this, they regularly sent in the Royal Air Force to restore order, as they would put it. Tribes often revolted in Syria too. They were among the losers of the Europeans' smug little arrangement. The new borders ran straight through their domains and divided their tribes, and families too, by the way. It was bad for the economy as well. Aleppo, for example, in northern Syria, had strong trade links with Mosul in Iraq. It had no such links with Damascus, nor any good railway connections even. The people of Aleppo mostly regarded Damascus as a historical rival, and naturally didn't like the fact that they would now have to call this smaller city their capital. Damascus, for its part, had close links with Palestine, which now lay on the other side of the border. But maybe the worst losers of the whole situation would turn out to be the Kurds. They were separated from each other by the new borders. Some would now become inhabitants of Iraq, others of Turkey. As for the Syrian Kurds, I've read that many of their ancestors only arrived in their current country in the 1920s, fleeing repression elsewhere. And yet, the Kurds would never come closer to having a country of their own than in the wake of the First World War. The Turks had picked the wrong side in the war, and as a consequence, the Treaty of Sèvres described how much of Turkey would be torn apart. Much of Anatolia would be assigned to a Kurdish state. When a Greek army marched in to enforce this, however, there was a major reaction from the Turks, which would become known as the Turkish War for Independence. Their leading officers vowed to do whatever they could to save what was left of the Ottoman Empire. They were led by the uncompromising Mustafa Kemal, who would become known as Atatürk, father of the Turks. He had already made a name for himself before. His men had dealt a terrible blow to the British during the World War, when they vainly tried to land at Gallipoli, planning to force their way to Istanbul from there. And the commander already showed his mentality at that time. He famously said to his men, "I don't order you to fight, I order you to die." Now, I don't know whether I would find that inspiring personally, but his men apparently did, because the British were driven away. The mastermind behind this failed plan of theirs was a certain Winston Churchill. It would become the worst humiliation of his entire career, I think. In the Turkish War of Independence, Mustafa Kemal would also drive his enemies back. The Allies could perhaps have forced his hand had they cared to. But knowing Kemal and the existential fight that this would be for the Turks, this would surely cost a lot more blood than treasure. The Allies could no longer muster the energy for that. They had their fill of war, so they chose to compromise with the Turks. And for that, they were willing to sacrifice the idea of a Kurdish state. The newly revised Pact of Lausanne no longer made mention of a Kurdish state. The British had no problem with that, for most Kurds had stayed loyal to the Ottomans during the war anyway. Today, Kurdish nationalists understandably commemorate this event as a great betrayal, but it must be said that at the time, their leaders were not all that interested in nationalism yet. They had more narrow interests, above all, to maintain their privileges and expand their patronage at the expense of their rivals. True, a first generation of Kurdish nationalists had already emerged during the palliative phase of the Ottoman Empire, but it was not mature enough to have any real impact on the world stage when it counted. Case of bad timing, perhaps. They also differed greatly about which regions ought to be part of this new Kurdistan, according to them. And in all fairness, suppose that in a parallel universe, the victors of World War I would have created a Kurdistan for the first time in history. Do you think that this new country would then be seen as any less of a colonial relic than, say, Iraq or Syria? Would its borders be any less artificial? There were Kurds living in Iran too, for instance. Absorbing them was never on the cards. And what about all the other ethnicities living in this future Kurdistan? It's an open question. As a result, however, the relationship between the Kurds and their new countries became very problematic. The fact that their mountains were now separated by new borders was disturbing for their way of life and for their welfare. This became a reason for resistance, but it also facilitated this resistance. Guerrillas could always withdraw behind the border and fill their war chests with smuggling profits. Once the Europeans left, the independent countries became rivals, and they all used Kurdish rebels to destabilize each other. And this, in turn, all meant that they would become a distrusted minority everywhere. This selective cooperation and oppression would boost Kurdish nationalism, but it also perpetuated the Kurds' internal divisions. This has remained the case to this day. The patronizing idea behind the mandates was that the Europeans had the more advanced societies, that they would now help bring the Arabs closer to their standards. But nothing of the sort happened. In Syria, for example, the French would privilege their own companies and citizens over the locals, which was one of the reasons why certain business groups had lobbied for French involvement there anyway. Agreed, for France itself, the mandate would not be profitable. It did invest there, but mostly in security, or as many Syrians would call it, repression, and that was also what local taxes would often be used for. If a road was built, then locals suspected that this was only done to make it easier for tax collectors and troops to access distant regions. The backbreaking labor often had to be done by the locals too. They were simply forced to do it. This sparked a huge uprising in the Druze region, which then spread to many other regions in Syria. This would come as a double shock to the French. First, if they expected someone to start a rebellion, it would be the Sunni majority, not one of the minorities. And secondly, they were astonished that the revolt spread to other groups and regions. The French had done all they could to sow discord between them by posing as protectors of the minorities. And not just posing, one of the reasons that the French were interested in Syria at all was to protect Christians. And even other small sects like the Druze or the Alevites, which they didn't consider Islamic, some saw Islam itself as an anti-modern force. The hope was that these minorities would in turn come to see the French as a life insurance, a guarantee that the Sunni majority could not marginalize them. Not unlike Assad during the Arab Spring, the French would play up the fanaticism of Muslim rebels, but in reality, sectarian animosity was limited in the mandatory period, as attested by the approval of the moderate rhetoric of Faisal. The importance of sectarian differences waxes and wanes over the centuries, but when it rises, that's often because certain people actively try to drive a wedge for their own cynical purposes, be it terrorists or politicians. While Faisal had tried to unite the Syrians, the French had done the opposite. They partitioned Syria in supposedly autonomous regions, so that the minorities would have their own domain, the Alevites in the north, the Druze in the south, and the Christians in the west. Eventually, they would try to separate the minority regions from the rest of Syria, so as to at least keep these under control. But as it turned out, only Lebanon would become independent. Unsurprisingly, most nationalists were Sunni Arabs, by far the largest group. To keep the Sunnis down and divided, they manipulated elections and made sure that minorities would be overrepresented. They also separated the region of Aleppo from that of Damascus, hoping to play upon the historic rivalry between these areas. They would soon feel forced to abandon this plan, however, and merge the two. They eventually found themselves facing a massive Sunni bloc, the very thing that they had tried to avoid from the start, and even the minorities came to recognize that they were being used in a cynical game of divide and rule. And they started to champion unification with the rest of Syria too. The common struggle against the foreign oppressor united the Syrians, and by the time that the revolt died down, there had emerged a sense of Syrian nationalism among practically all parts of society. find this pretty ironic, since modern Syria itself would not have existed had it not been for this foreign enemy. It's not hard to see why, considering how the French handled this crisis. In fact, it invites comparison with the way that the Assads handled the Arab Spring. The French, too, soon found that they lacked the manpower to keep all the rebellious areas under control, and they came up with a similar solution as Assad would do, to pull out of these areas and then start meting out collective punishment. The dead were sometimes displayed openly as a warning. John McHugo goes so far as to write that, quote, "The French Air Force conducted what may well have been the most intensive and systematic aerial bombardments against the civilian population that had taken place up to that time anywhere in the world, as their planes returned to bomb villages on a daily basis," unquote. And to understand fully what that would mean, consider that this was after the First World War. Coincidentally, the first place where this brutal tactic was tried out was Hama, which happens to be the first town to rebel against the Assad regime and be flattened in response back in 1982. The similarities between now and a century ago are sobering. Practically everyone in the West is perplexed by the cruelties that the Assad regime was willing to commit to fan the flames of the Arab Spring. But as Europeans, we must be willing to take a hard look in the mirror and realize that what our own ancestors did in the not-so-distant past was not that much better. Not to excuse it, as some apologists do, "You did it too, so shut up about it." That's missing the point. Two wrongs don't make a right. The reason we need to keep this in mind, I think, is to remind ourselves that there is nothing inherently Arab or Muslim or inhuman about all this. If you're not careful, you might start to think that only uncivilized people do such things. But it's that sort of reasoning that made the mandates sound like a good idea to its proponents at the time. What this can show, at least I think, is that the terrible logic behind this is all too human, unfortunately. Now, if the Assads studied the French example, they didn't pay close enough attention, because the result was that the Syrians would share a trauma now that would lead them to identify more closely with one another. The experience united them against the French. So the brutal approach was not just immoral, it was counterproductive. There was one group, however, that stayed out of the revolt, the Alevites. At first sight, this was surprising, for they had already rebelled on their own long ago. But the French had been able to isolate the Alevite district from the rest of Syria, because it had few trade links with the south. They were mostly concentrated on the north, on what was now Turkey. The French would make the most of that. They encouraged Alevites to pursue a career in the army. This would have consequences to this day. As we've seen, under the Syrian Baath, Alevites gained power in the army and finally over the whole country. They would then assign Alevite minors to all Sunnis who held important positions, which, by the way, they could have learned from the French, for these also appointed advisors to all key local officials. Much like the French made sure that vulnerable minorities would be overrepresented in the Syrian armed forces, so the British would fill the Iraqi officer corps with Sunnis, who were, as you know, a minority in Iraq. This would still be the case under Saddam Hussein, by the way, and it would partly explain why the army wouldn't revolt during the war with Iran. But like Saddam had his own super loyal Republican guards just in case of trouble, so the British used a different force, the levies, to put down rebellions. These consisted mostly of Assyrians, which was a minuscule community. Already during the First World War, the Assyrians were affectionately referred to as "our smallest ally" by some of the British. But once British influence in Iraq diminished, the Assyrians would quickly be denounced as traitors, and thousands would be massacred. All considered, the English had an easier time controlling Iraq than the French did in Syria. In both countries, the old elite from the Ottoman era consisted mostly of Sunni Arabs, but in Syria, these also made up the bulk of the population. In case the French left, these would have a good chance to become the leaders of their own country. In Syria, some Sunni politicians had every reason to ask for one person, one vote. Not so in Iraq. There, the elite was also Arab and Sunni, but in the population as a whole, that group only represented a minority. Shiites and Kurds lacked the connections and the experience to attain high positions, and many of them were suspicious of the authorities anyway. As I explained in the series on Iran, for Shiites, this is practically a religious dogma, and the Kurds usually try to keep the central authorities at bay too. It's often said that the Kurds have no friends but their mountains, and this was no less true then than it is now. Besides, many Shiites and Kurds were loyal to hard-headed tribal chiefs. Little wonder the authorities regarded them as troublemakers. In exchange for cooperation, the Royal Air Force would keep the tribes at bay. The landlords were allowed to keep their land, the civil servants to keep their offices. These things were all interconnected. One reason why landlords dominated parliament, for instance, was that as long as the vote wasn't secret, they could force their tenants to vote for them. Failing to do so was likely to get you evicted. Of course, the mandatory powers could have done something about it, but they were perfectly fine with it. They talked a good game about democracy, but they couldn't keep their friends in power if elections had been free and fair, so they manipulated them in all sorts of ways. And if the outcome of a vote was still not to their liking, they refused to abide by it. Especially the French have a bad record on this. The Syrians had made plain, for instance, that they wanted Faisal for their king, but they drove him out. They wanted a constitution, the French rejected it. In Iraq, things were not much better. So it's not, as you often hear, that Syrians and Iraqis don't have any experience with democratic procedures. They do. They were just bad experiences, and that may have made them a little cynical. Just as unfair as the methods that kept the elite in power was what they did with it. Both the lawgivers and the administrators were part of a small clique, and they used their position to push through legislation that further disadvantaged the have-nots. For instance, it would be prohibited to accept a tenant who had outstanding debts, and this applied to almost all. This bound the poor to their masters, who remained free to exploit them. Moreover, the magnates hardly had to contribute to the financing of a state that took such good care of them. This ensured that the poor stayed poor while the rich got rich. In Syria, too, notables kept their enviable positions. Perhaps calculating that things could be a lot worse for them, most left the revolutionary adventures to the poor. Say what you will of the revolutionary mass parties that would arise in the Cold War era, but at least they tended to pay heed to the needs of common people, which could not be said of the conservative governments that came before. I guess you can also tell why the socialist ideas would appeal to the masses in the 50s and 60s. Despite all this, I think we must resist the temptation to exaggerate the importance of the mandatory period out of all proportion. Especially in Iraq, it really didn't last that long. Already in 1932, the British and the Iraqi government came to an agreement, and Iraq could join the Club of Free Nations. It did have to agree to important concessions, however, like letting the British station troops in the country and to assist in case of war. This was a remarkably smooth transfer of power, especially if you consider the violence and the revenge killings that tend to accompany decolonizations. The key difference is that the British were only in Iraq for a short spell, and they didn't expect to stay long. So instead of ruling the country directly, instead of moving large numbers of Englishmen to Iraq, they left dependable notables in charge. It was a cozy understanding for both parties, and it enabled an easy transition of power. Perhaps it could have gone similarly in France. After the Syrian revolt, there emerged a new generation of politicians known as the Nationalist Bloc. Its members did want independence, but expressly did not want revolution, because practically all of them belonged to the land-owning class. They managed to convince the other parliamentarians, who were mostly independents, to propose a constitution along the lines of that of next-door Iraq. But Not for the first or the last time, the French refused to respect the will of the Syrian people's representatives. Syria would not become independent until after World War II, and even then the French wouldn't leave voluntarily. But we'll come to that. Back in Iraq, with Britain officially gone, the restive tribes felt that their moment had now come. They ramped up the pressure and even marched on the capital at some point. But alas for them, the Iraqi army had now become professional and modern enough to make short work of them. But for the government, this was not the end of the troubles. Now it would be the generals who would decide its fate. They used the tribes as boogeymen to blackmail the government. Either you give in to our demands, or we stand aside as the tribes ransack the city. It was the implicit threat. So generals now came to determine both the composition of the government and its policies. And less than 5 years after the departure of the British, they seized power themselves for the first time. At first sight, the military men were merely new players playing an old game. But two important things did change. The first was that now that they were in power themselves, they had no more reason to go gentle on the tribes. They could no longer use them as bargaining chips or anything. A show of force by Shia tribesmen was quickly crushed, and after this, the tribes would never again pose an existential threat. The introduction of the draft in 1934 would ensure that there wouldn't be no way back. But that did not mean that clan loyalty would also disappear. Far from doing away with tribal logic, the state machinery became itself saturated with it. After their penultimate failed rebellion, the sheikhs were co-opted. They came to constitute a large proportion of parliamentary representatives. Their grip on their tribesmen hardened, and it became more and more like that of the landlords versus their tenants. Landlords and chiefs became ever more aware of their shared interests. As Hitchak Nakash proposes, they developed a class consciousness, while traditionally they would feel more connected to their own poorer tribesmen and responsible for them. In time, Saddam Hussein even handed judiciary and other state powers back to the chieftains, encouraged city dwellers to join a tribe, and openly propagated the tribal virtues. In 1988, he even legalized honor killings. As we've seen, this undermined the institutional foundations of the state, replacing them with personal ties between the dictator and those chiefs who would become his clients. But this was less revolutionary than it may sound, because tribalism already permeated the Iraqi state. And nor was it pure calculation. Tribal affiliations were part and parcel of Saddam's worldview, and that of many others. The second thing that would change, with officers holding power, was Iraq's foreign policy. Unlike the civilian leaders before them, the officers had no sense of loyalty to the British. They didn't feel that they needed protection. But the British wouldn't just let go of Iraq. Their presence had hardly diminished. The relationship became even more important for Great Britain as tensions in Europe started to run high. Iraqi officers were fascinated by Hitler and fascism, as could be expected, while the old elite, led by Nouri al-Said, remained loyal to the British. Nouri rightly presumed that with a major conflict looming, the British would not allow Iraq to slip into the enemy camp. Indeed, the British would claim that the pro-German Iraqi government had disrespected its treaty obligations, and that they could therefore intervene militarily. During a renewed occupation, they reinstalled Nouri, would waste no time purging the army and the civil service. By the time the dust had settled, he had become more powerful than ever. It was in a way yet another smooth transition. In Syria, it was another matter entirely. The looming war had given the French another pretext to put independence on the back burner. But that proved a mistake. France was itself taken over by Germany, and the French administrators in Syria decided to join the collaborating Vichy regime. Now, to win over the Syrians, the Free French had to act as if they'd wanted to grant independence all along, which was not all that convincing, as you can imagine. They dropped pamphlets from the sky, promising freedom. But when Syria was reconquered by the Allies, they already acted as if this had never happened. Incredibly, they now again use the war as an excuse to postpone things. If they let Syria go now, they argued, this would be unpopular in France, and the collaborators of Vichy would use this as a propaganda tool. But when Hitler was defeated eventually, it didn't turn out to make any difference. The French agreed to talk about independence, sure, but only on their pretty unacceptable conditions. However, the French weren't the only ones who had signed these solemn pledges. The British had underwritten them too. They too had given their word, and if they now broke it, they would alienate the Iraqis. As it happened, the British were the ones in control of the terrain in Syria, even more so than after World War I. So they were in a position to pressure the French to allow elections. These were overwhelmingly won by the Syrian nationalists. And still, the French acted as sore losers. They only backed down because the British forced their hand. But not before bombing the Syrian capital, even the parliament building. I think you could hardly think of a more symbolic admission of the hypocrisy behind the pretensions of the mandate, as meant to prepare the Syrians for freedom. Syrians may remember this when they hear Europeans preach about democracy, and if not, then their less than democratic leaders will be eager to refresh their memories. Of course, that again misses the point. Just because a foreigner refused to give Syrians democracy in the past doesn't mean that one of their own can do the same today. I think this should be obvious, but not everyone seems to agree. The elected Syrian government, for its part, needed no convincing of the worth of democracy or of its fragility. Its ministers knew all too well that Iraq had been taken over by its army so soon after independence. Worse, they had little control over their own army, which the French had filled with minorities, so they did not trust their own officers. And unlike the Iraqis, they didn't need a strong army anyway to protect them from menacing tribes. They wanted to first fill the army's higher ranks with more reliable people before trusting it with better equipment. And in the meantime, they intended to keep the armed forces weak. But that became untenable after the repeated humiliations against Israel. Israel's victory against its neighbors in 1948 is often presented as an incredible feat for the Jewish state. It was actually quite logical, especially where Syria is concerned. This country was no older than Israel. It emerged from a turbulent period too, as we've seen, and it had deliberately weakened and destabilized its own army. Moreover, Syria kept many troops in reserve because they feared that the Jordanian king would be tempted to use the situation to take over Syria himself. So this Syrian army, weak as it was, also entered the war half-heartedly, what could you expect? But good luck explaining that to the Syrian people. They had no reason to expect such a defeat. Politicians now saw an opportunity. They wanted to blame the disaster on the supreme commander, so they could get rid of him. But he reacted by taking power himself. So the policy of keeping the army weak had backfired in a way. It had brought about the very outcome that it was meant to avoid. Even a weak army, it turns out, can overpower a few politicians, especially as these lack support. But some suspect the USA of being involved in this coup. The civilian government had done some things to anger it, and the new dictator went out of his way to please it. He was even willing to go very far to make peace with the Israelis. But the Syrians were not, nor were most other officers, so this dictator didn't last long. Several counter-coups followed in quick succession, and by the time that parliament reopened, many had lost confidence in democratic principles and in the countries that preached them, including the USA. As for the ambitious, they had learned that political defeat equaled death, and so that you never relinquish power voluntarily. It was a road to dictatorship. In Iraq too, it was hardly a triumphant period for democracy. Nouri al-Said may have been a civilian politician, but his instincts and methods were not those of a democrat. He could fill state coffers as Iraqi oil production took off for the first time, while nationalizations in Iran under Mossadegh urged the oil men to grant Nouri a better deal. He did use this money to expand social facilities, but to use them, you needed connections. the expansion of the state served to expand the leader's client base. Or consider how he dealt with opposition. He would announce modest concessions, making people feel safe enough to take to the streets and ask for genuine change. He then used the demonstrations as a pretext to start a new purge and refill his prisons. It all sounds a lot like the honeymoon days of Bashar al-Assad, no? But those who make peaceful change impossible often make violent change inevitable, and Nouri would discover this firsthand. Since peaceful opposition and dialogue had proven pointless and dangerous, the resistance now went underground and became more violent. And as the Iraqi government ought to have known by then, the more dictatorial it behaved, the more it came to depend on its armed forces. By the late 50s, the so-called Free Officers staged another coup, and this time it proved fatal, for Nouri and for the entire royal family. Those who succeeded him as Iraq's leaders would meet a similar fate. Like in Syria, if you play the game of politics in Iraq, you either win or die. This was not inevitable, I think. It's through precedent that this became the rule. This may also explain, though not excuse, how far the Assad regime was willing to go to hold on to power. Its main goal is ultimately self-preservation. So let's return to the question that we started the episode with. Many people would still say that Britain and France are guilty of all the horrors that befell Iraq and Syria, even a century after they left. Is this fair? You have no doubt heard the analogy of the divine watchmaker. It's the idea that at the beginning of time, God created the laws of physics and set everything in motion, before moving on to other interests. And why not? For once finished, a clock should be able to work on its own, right? Except, where would that leave us? If our actions are also completely predetermined by the same laws of nature, then whoever started the whole thing might be the sole responsible for all that happens, no? But what if we are free to change our own destiny? I suppose it's a philosophical question. However, if we apply this analogy to the Middle East, then the implications get rather more concrete. You could say that a country is a complicated device too, much like a watch. Then in the case of Syria and Iraq, the makers would be the French and the British. If they are still fully responsible for all that has gone wrong in the following century, that would imply that the locals had no agency whatsoever, and I don't see why that would be the case. Sure, this particular watchmaker has made a mess of things. It worked badly from the start. And instead of showing the customer how to keep their new country in good working order, they intentionally made things so that different communities would distrust each other. In fact, this was no voluntary sale at all, of course. And there is no reason why the British and the French would know more about building a working country than the locals. Syrians and Iraqis didn't want the Europeans to create their lands for them. They naturally wanted to make their own. So, why didn't they? Think about it. If the Europeans could create the modern Middle East, as they say, why couldn't Syrians and Iraqis simply dispose of these unwanted creations afterwards? Why didn't they erase these unnatural boundaries and start anew? Well, post-independence politicians vowed to do just that. But instead, mostly for selfish reasons, they made these new countries stronger, deepened the artificial borders, and within them, they played different groups off against one another. Just like those pesky Europeans had done. We've seen why and how in previous episodes. So I guess that my conclusion would be that yes, some Europeans, who are all long dead by now, do share some of the responsibility, or the blame, but they are merely one piece of the puzzle. Those that influenced events in the years that came after were at least as important, and so were those that came before. For indeed, the Europeans didn't create this region from scratch, they merely held it for a few decades, made a few changes, most of them unhelpful, and then passed it on again. But they had taken this region over from someone else, who had held it for many centuries, the Ottomans. They are at least as much the creators of the Middle East as the British and the French. but I'll explain that in the next episode. Talk to you then. Thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye.